Turn the page. It's the bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Good afternoon. I'm Batya Bricker, and you are listening to Chai FM's Bookmark, home of stories and the people who love them. There are careers, and then there are callings. A career is something you choose, but a calling is something that chooses you. Today's show is about remarkable people whose lives have been shaped by a sense of purpose larger than themselves. It's those people who've dedicated themselves to serving others, to protecting the natural world, preserving history and heritage, or caring for creatures that can't speak for themselves. It's people who have looked at a need and decided not to walk past. One of the great privileges of books is that it allows us to spend time in the company of such people. Through memoirs, biographies, and extraordinary true stories, we are invited into lives driven not by profit or prestige, but by conviction. We meet conservationists who devote decades to protecting endangered species, historians and archivists who rescue fragile stories from being lost to time, community builders who preserve cultures, language, and traditions, individuals who feel called to serve their communities, often quietly and without fanfare. These are not the stories that dominate headlines. More often than not, they're stories of persistence rather than drama, stewardship rather than celebrity. They remind us that a meaningful life is often built not on grand gesture, but on showing up day after day in service of something that matters. The first two books I'm going to talk about, the one is, they're both environment books, and these are people who have made it their life's work to preserve what has been our natural heritage. The first book is called Tracks in the Dust by Mario Cassar. He was raised on Sicilian family stories and the constant bustle of his family's Italian restaurant. You may have known Roma back in the day. It was in the heart of Johannesburg. And Mario Cassar grew up rooted in this tradition, but really his heart was elsewhere. And from an early age, he was drawn to open spaces and the untamed edges of the world beyond the city. Nature was never a passing fascination. It was a calling that he could not ignore. And that calling led him deep into South Africa's most prestigious game reserves, Thornybush, Malamala, Olifants, where beauty and brutality exist side by side. As a game ranger on the front lines of conservation, Mario faced the grim realities behind South Africa or Africa's wildlife tourism, the armed poachers, the mutilated animals, and the constant emotional toll of protecting those who cannot protect themselves. From rescuing orphaned rhino calves beside their poached mothers, to tracking dangerous criminals with his trusted canine partner, Saba, who we have met in previous books, Mario's journey is one of courage, of heartbreak, and unwavering commitment. It's not a romanticized tale of the bush, but a raw, honest account of what it truly means to be the life of a game ranger in South Africa. And I wanted to give you a sense of Mario's supreme skill at storytelling. He starts with his very early years and how he found school so incredibly difficult. And this is what he writes about school and the time then. No one could beat my biology marks. My closest rival, Elsa De Silva, will remember. Whenever she missed beating me by a mark or two, I'd look across the classroom and smile, only to find her dark Spanish eyes glaring at me. But biology was all I had. For the rest of my subjects, I muddled along and did my best to stay out of trouble with the teachers. Honestly, I would happily have conceded a couple of marks to Elsa now and then just to see her smile instead of pout, and maybe, just maybe, get the nod from her for some study time together. However, after some introspection on self-preservation, I put my thoughts of a so-called friendship on the back burner. Not only did she live two bus rides away from the school, but I suspected her father still kept the sword he had used to kill the bull for her mother. And then later, as his life becomes engulfed in the environment and protecting it, this is him talking about the biodiversity of the Magaliesberg area, which is kind of where he started on his conservationist journey. at the time, he was talking about Cape vultures becoming familiar with the cradle of humankind and the Sterkfontein site that it's now called. And he writes, even then, barely 16 years old, I can remember how humbling it felt to stand where the earliest hominids had lived millions of years ago. I was breathing the same air and feeling the same sun on my skin. I imagined they'd listened to many of the same sounds I was hearing. I pictured them huddled in fear when they heard the call of approaching predators at night. They would have smelled the same earth after a thunderstorm and the smoke from the burning grass where lightning set the felt ablaze. Looking up at the steep mountainside one morning, I had an epiphany. It wasn't a light bulb moment, more like a dimmer switch progressively turning up. With the sun shining directly on the imposing cliff face, I was able to see the extent of the larger Cape vulture colonies, and in stark contrast to the ochre-coloured rock, pasty white streaks of vulture poop, also known as whitewash, ran down the myriad nesting sites. Pivoting, I turned my gaze away from the cliffs to scan the sky for any sign of vulture activity, and soon I was rewarded. Circling in an ever-tightening vortex, I could see dozens of vultures homing in on something in the valley below. A few were already perched on the leafless branches on a nearby dead tree, while others confidently landed on the ground. And using the dead tree as a direction indicator, I marked the spot and made my way there as quickly as I could. When I got to within 50 meters of the vultures on the ground, it was clear that they had been eating something. And he goes on to describe the carcass, which I won't do on radio. But at the time, I viewed the incident for what it was. Rather than looking deeper, I didn't know what questions to ask or what to make of the situation. I was more concerned how that antelope had died than what had killed it. I had no concept of the bigger picture, that I was witnessing a scenario playing out that was as old as mankind's earliest time on these plains. Using comparatively recent studies on the biodiversity of the surrounding countryside, I was able to look back in time to what I imagined was needed to survive in the Magaliesberg area back then. On the face of it, I concluded that it wasn't much different to what the resident wildlife keep in good condition today. If anything, the area might have had a slightly higher annual rainfall, but besides for the excellent climate, I believe that Homo naledi probably chose this area for its rich natural resources and the proximity to the cave system with a series of narrow entrances. This provided shelter and refuge from the larger predators and in some cases burial sites. Clearly security was a deciding factor even then, and nothing has changed in this regard. Mario is a modern day jock of the bushveld. He is a supreme storyteller. You can't help but be captivated by his stories. They are deeply human and powerfully told. Tracks in the Dust, a game ranger's journey, is about purpose, sacrifice, and answering a call that was always there. After the break, we will shift our focus from the animals and birds precious to us, a little closer to home and a little closer to humans. For more than four decades, Rabbi Moshe Silberhaft has dedicated his life to the Jewish community scattered across the vast landscapes of rural and regional South Africa and Africa. Traveling thousands of kilometers each year, he has become known as the Rabbi on the Road, bringing not only religious leadership, but companionship, comfort, continuity, and connection to communities that might otherwise feel forgotten. It's his work that is practical and deeply spiritual, a calling rooted in service, heritage, and an unwavering commitment to people. Today, we will be joined by historian and writer David Sachs, who helped bring these remarkable stories to the page. And we'll explore in Rabbi Moshe Silberhaft's new book, The Traveling Rabbi, Journeys Continued, the moments of joy and loss, the preservation of community and memory, and what it means to devote a lifetime to ensuring that no Jew, no matter how remote, is truly ever alone. Don't go away.
Turn the page. It's The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Welcome back. I'm Batya Bricker, and you are listening to Chai FM's Bookmark, the home of stories and the people who love them. Today's show is all about remarkable people, whose lives have been shaped by a sense of purpose larger than themselves. People who've dedicated themselves to serving others, to protecting the natural world, preserving history and heritage, or caring for creatures that cannot speak for themselves. We now turn our attention to a heritage and lifestyle very close to our hearts. And we welcome to the studio a person who has made it his life's work to preserve and enable a Jewish way of life, or at least part of it, for every single Jew, not only in South Africa, but on the African continent, no matter how far flung they may be. For more than three decades, Rabbi Moshe Silberhaft has traveled the roads less traveled, from remote farming towns in the Northern Cape to tiny Jewish communities scattered across Southern and East Africa. He has been a rabbi, a teacher, a counselor, a historian, caretaker of cemeteries, preserver of heritage, and often simply a friend. In places where Jewish life has dwindled to a handful of people and sometimes a single individual, he has ensured that no community is forgotten, no story is lost, and no person left disconnected from their heritage. His latest book is called The Traveling Rabbi, Journeys Continued, and it launches in a few weeks' time. It was written by researcher and historian and writer David Sachs, and it's much more than just a travel memoir. It's a remarkable record of service, of calling, of connection, a portrait of Jewish life across South Africa and the continent, and a reminder that heritage lives not only in buildings and archives, but in the people, in relationships and memory. So today on Bookmark, I am delighted to welcome Rabbi Moshe Silberhaft and writer and historian David Sachs. A very warm welcome to both of you.
Hi. Thank you very much.
Rabbi Moshe, many people choose a profession, but your work is a calling. You write a little bit, or you speak a little bit, about that 14-year-old who traveled to Messina to help with the High Holy Day services. And that journey changed your life. Can you tell us a little bit about that, and also what that has meant for the rest of your career?
Yeshiva College saw the importance of sending high school boys to travel and conduct services in the small communities going back over 45 years ago. And as you say, my first posting was to Messina, which is on the Zimbabwe border. And my immediate connection to the country community Jews, their love of Judaism, their sincerity, their genuineness to Judaism just grabbed me immediately. And their appreciation for our efforts to come to them and bring them the Yiddishkeit that we were taught and we lived in Johannesburg was so welcoming, just drew me to the love of their genuineness, should I say, of Yiddishkeit. And when I say Yiddishkeit, it's not what we understand today in 2026, Yiddishkeit. Their Yiddishkeit was coming to shul, making sure that there was a minyan, a yahrzeit candle, a Jewish calendar, making sure there was a minyan, making sure that they came to the minyan, making sure that they closed their businesses on Yontif, making sure that in the town all the Jewish businesses were closed. That was their Yiddishkeit. And that genuineness really grabbed me.
And the Zionism, of course, that commitment to Israel was also very much part of the small-town Jewish life from the beginning.
Absolutely. Very, very strong.
Yeah, I think it's something that as Jews in Johannesburg, you kind of take for granted that all those things are laid out for you with very little effort. You can pop over to, I don't know, Moishe's and grab your meat, and you can go down to Kollel downstairs and get your book, and, you know, Kosher World, wherever you are, it's really easy. If you want a minyan, it's really on the next block. But that incredible effort and, I guess, commitment to keeping things alive and keeping things going. Do you think that it encouraged many people, what I'm thinking is that it encouraged many people who might not actually have been involved in a Jewish life, but because they felt that weight of responsibility, they took it on.
They wanted to take it on. It was not only a responsibility, but they wanted to take it on, not only for themselves, for their children. In many of the towns, not only Messina, where all the children, many of them were at the King David Hostel at the time. It was an active hostel. All their kids used to come up to be with their family for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. But in many of the towns, the children used to come back to be with their families over the Yontavim. It used to boost the minyan, but also they were with their families, and it was so important. Yontav time to be with family was essential, and they did it because that was their connection to Yiddishkeit, to Judaism. That was their link from their parents to the next generation. And also in the town, we need to understand, you know, in a town called Otzorn, which in the 1905-1910 had over 600 Jewish families. It was larger than Cape Town. And Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, the entire town used to come to a standstill. And on first day of Rosh Hashanah, all the non-Jewish people used to line the streets and greet the Jews as they left shul. And the Jews used to bless them, and the non-Jews used to say, thank you, thank you. And can you just imagine 600 Jewish families? There were two shuls in those days, and they were really, really religious Jews. The non-Jews respected them for that, and they acknowledged them. And even in these small towns, when I went to cash my first check, it was 200 Rand in Messina, in those days, which was checks. And I went to the bank, and the Afrikaans lady behind the counter, I was 14 years old, I had my kippah on, and she said to me, "Is Yaya Yuit?" I said, "Yes." She says, "Is Yaya Echte Yuit? Are you a genuine Jew?" I said, "Yes." She called all the ladies from behind the counter, and she said, "Look, this is an echte Yurt." And she wasn't being anti-Semitic, as a Jew would say today. They were so in awe of an absolute real Jew with a kippah, a religious Jew. They knew the Jews in the town. But here was an observant Jew that came to the town, that they saw, came to conduct the services. They were in such awe. I always tell the story, I'm not sure it's in this book, it may be in the previous book, that in Victoria West we had to exhume two bodies that the cemetery was rezoned for commercial use.
Yeah, it is in this book, yeah.
It is in this book. Yeah. And the health minister, the representative from the health ministry, had to be present. It was a colored lady. And once we finished the exhumation, etc., I was all dressed in the special medical outfit. And once I undressed from it and everything, she saw my kippah and she saw my tzitzit and everything. She said to me, "You know, I've never seen a Jew." She said, "I see Jews on TV with Israel and the fighting and etc. and Zionism, but I've never, can I touch you?" She said. She said, "I'm an observant Christian. I go to church, but I've actually never seen or interacted with God's chosen people. Can I touch you?" She was in such awe. And we have to understand that we Jews in South Africa have that background, that history. It's not what we see today. We have a very, very rich history in South Africa where the Jews were considered and are the chosen nation. And sure, there was the Broederbond and there was anti-Jewish sentiments. But in general, the Jews in the small towns were highly regarded.
And you know, I think that's the theme that comes through in the book, is the immense wellsprings of goodwill towards largely the memory of the Jewish communities of these small towns that once flourished there. You know, it's been years since they've been gone for a long time, but the memory lingers amongst the local population. And I think Moshe's interactions with ordinary people on the ground has really, really, really revealed that sense of I think of gratitude and respect for the Jewish heritage of their towns of the past. And they make a great effort as well to preserve it, very often by voluntarily looking after the cemeteries. You find a lot of non-Jews who take it upon themselves to keep them in good condition. It's a very moving thing.
You have often said that caring for a cemetery is caring for a community's dignity. And a lot of your work now centers around that, around death and burial and keeping the cemeteries in respectful and honorable ways. What goes through your mind when you are standing in a remote cemetery where there may no longer be Jews living by, and what is informing your sense of purpose there?
Interesting question. We as Jews understand that just as living together and worshiping together, we buried together as Jews. That's why we have Jewish cemeteries. We consecrate our Jewish cemeteries before we start getting buried in them. But in many of the towns, in most of the towns, in fact, in South Africa, we look after approximately 220 Jewish cemeteries comprising of over 30,000 Jewish graves. And that's all that's left. And in these cemeteries are people, thousands of them, that managed to escape Eastern Europe, came from Lithuania, and they managed to escape Eastern Europe. They played a huge role in South Africa. They built communities under very difficult circumstances. They raised Jewish children, sent them to the bigger centers because they didn't want their kids to remain in the small towns. And they remained there, and they got buried there. What upsets me a lot is that out of these 30,000 people buried there, if I get 20 calls a year from descendants of these people to say, listen, my Bobo or my Zeda or my child is buried in one of these towns, what does a grave look like? Can we assist? That's a lot. Mm-hmm. And that to me is an absolute disgrace, I'm sorry to say, that Jewish people can behave like this, because we should look after our descendants and our ancestors, and I hope that our children don't do that to us one day. But you stand there and you read the names of these people, and then you go back and you look at the records and the research that South African Friends of Beit HaTfotzot are doing. They're now publishing their seventh publication. And you read, first of all, the history of these people. And then you read the immense, huge contribution that they made, not only to their community, but to the wider community. It's invaluable. It's words cannot describe how essential and how important it is to that development of their community, to themselves, that they got out of Eastern Europe and they didn't throw in the towel. They actually rebuilt their lives.
Being part of the wider society, and the number of Jewish mayors in these little towns, tiny communities, but I think Mafeking had six. And we're talking about a few score Jews at their hut. Extraordinary.
Giving dignity to their place of burial is a way of honoring their contribution to society, to the community, to the Jewish people, to humanity as a whole. But the work you do is not only focused on the dead or the dying. It's also about connecting remaining Jews, far-flung they may be, to their heritage and faith. I wonder how many boxes of matzahs you have delivered in remote parts. Have you kept count?
I haven't kept count, but there are thousands that go out every year.
Imagine.
Both in South Africa and Southern Africa. We distribute to Kenya, to Zimbabwe, Zambia, all over Southern Africa and throughout South Africa.
But it's not really
Namibia as well.
It's not really about the matzah. It's about saying you are part of us, you count, we value, we care about you. Can you tell us some stories around this part of your work?
Well, you need to understand, as I said earlier, most people in the small communities, Pesach is an essential part, Knedlach. People hearing the word Knedlach will smile and think, ah, you know. But you know, a Knedlach for some people, that's a lot of part of their Pesach. Mm-hmm. To us in Johannesburg, our rabbis of today teach us that you have to sit and you have to spend till just before midnight on the first night, and then after midnight you can carry on. But for these people, that's irrelevant. It's totally irrelevant. We've lost the plot in many cases. Sorry, rabbis that are listening to this, don't throw the stones at me. But for these people, I was in Namibia a few weeks ago. I was in Swakopmund, and I met a number of people, and there is Chabad in Namibia, and they go around and they deliver one piece of shmura matzah to each Jew in that area, and they're very welcoming of it. But they said, what are we going to do with this one burnt piece of round matzah? They want matzah meal. They want matzah so they can make knedlach. Like the Boba used to make. That's their yontif. Yeah. That's what I always say to people. You know, we mustn't negate that how important a Yahrzeit candle is, how important a Jewish calendar is. We print thousands and thousands of Jewish calendars, which we send out, distribute free to South African, our country communities, to make sure that, first of all, they know when is yontif. Second of all, that there's when the Yahrzeit is of their descendants. We send out thousands of Yahrzeit candles. That's their Yiddishkeit.
And even herring as well, chopped herring, they often get
kichel and herring.
You get requests for that often.
Absolutely. I was in Camus 2 weeks ago, which is 30 kilometers outside Uppington. And there's a Mr. Jack, I won't say his surname because it's a breach of confidentiality. And also for security, we don't give people's names out, obviously. And he's 94 years old. He's recently moved there from Durban. And I called him up and I said to his niece and nephew who look after him, he's very deaf, I said, what can I bring him? And they asked him and he said, I haven't had kichel and herring for I don't know how many years, please. And I brought him kichel and herring, brought him matzah, teglach. The man was like a little child. It is so, we need to understand that. it sounds cute and people laugh it off in Johannesburg because to them, running to the earliest minyan and the biggest minyan and hearing the most inspirational drosha and the rabbi speaks the best drosha is exciting. But to these Jews, we mustn't negate that. That's their Yiddishkeit.
And it's just as important as any other
them,
flavor.
Absolutely. The funny side of it is I was in Mozambique last week. It was the 100th anniversary of the Maputo Shul. And the president was our guest of honor. And he's 2 meters, 40 centimeters tall. He's apparently the tallest president to ever rule in a country.
Wow.
And we brought in kosher food from South Africa. And I introduced him to challah, to kitka, and kichel and herring. And he loved it. He's a Mozambican, obviously,
Dad
from
Frelimo. It doesn't
and he
get
loved
better
it.
Than that.
So, it's very, very important.
David, you are a historian.
Yes.
You're a man of faith, you're a writer, you're a researcher. And it's clear that Rabbi Silberhaft's raison d'etre is what attracts you to his story and his work. And in writing this book, what struck you most about his work, about his sense of purpose, and the unique contribution that he brings to the Jewish community?
Look, there's a whole range of things. You know, you mentioned it's travel literature, but it's an opportunity vicariously to go to parts of the country that are just places names on a map. I just love that. You know? Well, places some I've heard of, some I hadn't heard of, and it must be a wonderful thing to make. Moshe is part of he goes to these places regularly. He doesn't just visit. He's becomes part of. Yeah, you know, the whole country. I certainly love that. But being a historian, being with a background in the heritage industry, the great importance of preserving the physical heritage of the whole country, but the Jewish community in particular. And this is a very strong passion of Moshe's. What in the cemeteries, what was not mentioned is that there's now a practice of putting plaques, memorial plaques, commemorating the communities that were there, as well as some of the outstanding individuals who made an impact. So throughout the country now, you visit these beautifully kept cemeteries, well-preserved, which I really are a Kiddush Hashem, and sometimes they're even a tourist attraction. They're part of the town's tourism to come and visit the Jewish cemetery, and you also will have these plaques talking about the communities that once flourished there. So I certainly love that, and a lot of publications as well. We worked together on a number of important publications.
Livingston,
Livingston, the history of Namibia Jewry, won't mention them all, but I certainly love that aspect of the work. And also, as I was very much struck, as I mentioned already, those wellsprings of goodwill towards the Jewish people that exists to this day in these far-flung places as an enduring legacy of the Jewish presence there.
Yeah, it's comforting to hear that, heartwarming to hear that. You've spent your life and career really preserving heritage. Why is it so important to keep stories precious, to hold them, to preserve them for posterity?
I don't know. You know, I would say it's a feature of the South African Jewish community, which I don't think is that there is this passion for writing up the story, whether it's of the community as a whole or even a small town, the social history of Brakpan Jewry. I mean, it's one of the books that has appeared. There have been so many books. I think right from the beginning, there was a real sense of pride that Jews had in what they were doing in the country, and a passion to that it should be preserved for posterity, it shouldn't be forgotten, and that people, the future generations, should know about it and take pride in it. I don't know. And I certainly share that belief very much myself.
As a writer and editor of this book, Journeys Continued, there were no doubt stories that landed on the editing floor that's going to happen. Were there any favorite stories that you just loved and relished?
Moshe, should we talk about the Walter Geller tombstone?
Yeah, you can.
Okay, I mean, one of many. Oh, no, there's actually two. And the one is, I went to Grahamstown, Rose University in Grahamstown. I didn't know at the time about the Jewish connection. But the oldest Jewish cemetery in South Africa is in Grahamstown. It's not in Cape Town. The first Jewish burial took place there. And we actually wrote about that funeral in Jewish Affairs. It's a journal that I edit. It's under the auspices of the Board of Deputies. Working with Moshe, a plaque has now been placed on that historic grave, or that very first burial. Now it was towards the end of 1838. And that's just an example of us having these memorial plaques that are now being put into these places. So I live down the road from that cemetery. I didn't even know of its existence, and I'll always regret that. But the other one, the Walter Gallus story, it's a famous Namibian. And it actually happened is that there was a German Jew married to a non-Jewish woman, and he died in 1939, I think, and she couldn't afford a tombstone. And a little bit later, a tombstone was put up and gave his name and date of birth and death, and on the top in Hebrew writing, back to front, kosher lePesach, you know. That story features, but also the follow-up, but, you know, how it came about, this the story, how it came to be chiseled off. It was actually by the son of this German Jew who didn't want his father's grave to be laughed at anymore. And who this who he was, what his background was, where all these details were filled in, have subsequently been filled in. So it was very enjoyable to take that famous story, because it's very much part of Namibian Jewish folklore, and to just bring it to its conclusion, to let people know more about it. That's two of the many episodes that I loved writing about.
I loved listening to the stories about the time capsules, which appear more than once in this book, which I had no idea. The story of the grey shirt, and of course the claustrophobic corpse that didn't want to be transported to his place of burial by aeroplane and only by road. I did chuckle to myself. Rabbi Moshe, do you have any characters that stand out for you?
Well, it's a difficult one, because if I mention some and not others, it will cause faribles, you know.
All right, no, we don't want
so
that.
We don't want that. But, you know, also people say to me, what is your favorite place to visit? And I must say that every single place is absolutely perfect, and I undertake every visit as a as a new visit, and as a favorite place, because I really enjoy and I appreciate every single person that I meet, and there's no real one outstanding person, but you know, there's some amazing people that lived in the small towns. In Harare, you had a lady by the name of Ruth Feigenbaum, who was a part of the Black Sesh in South Africa, and she went to live in Zimbabwe eventually. She married Roy Feigenbaum. She was Ruth Bolnick in South Africa. And she had a dream to open something called Sagofati, which was a library for a facility for children that their parents had died from AIDS. And we helped raise money overseas for it. And when we opened it, there was over 450 children coming every day. This is around 2008, when Mr. Mugabe was destroying the country, taking away all the farms, etc. And people were leaving daily. And we raised money to build this facility. And the children, and I used to visit often, and used to take food up there and books. We got the whole library donated by an organization in Australia, and the children decided to call the library the Rabbi Moshe Library. And to this day, we still assist them with medication and various requirements, sports, footballs, and stuff that they require, sanitary stuff for the girls, etc. And there's one story that we tell in the book where I was holding a little girl when we opened it, and almost 20 years later, I came back there, and she approached me, and she said to me in their language, she said, "Grandfather, this is your, please meet your daughter. Father, please meet your granddaughter." And she had a baby, and she considered me her father, because we supported her throughout the years, and she appreciated what we did. And there are many children there that we assisted, and we still continue to assist. Raymond Roth, who's in Zimbabwe, in Bulawayo, a very prominent Jewish businessman in and communal leader in Bulawayo, still assists us. He's our middleman, conduit there. And there's just, I mean, people can read the book, and just every chapter, every page features one personality or two that are just, I would call them tzaddikim. I mean, today, when you hear from the young rabbis today, tzaddikim, you think of these great rabbis with gray beards that sleep on the floor and eat carrots or potatoes, you know. But these people are really tzaddikim. What they have done for a Kiddush Hashem, as David said earlier, what they have done to promote the wish of God, to better the underprivileged, not necessarily the Jewish underprivileged, but the wider community, is unbelievable. I was in Livingston recently at the beginning of the academic year, and we presented 100 school bags to kids in at a school in Livingston, and these children looked at me as if I was God Almighty. They had never seen new school bags that weren't in tatters, and the zips were working, and the back straps were working, and they were just, I mean, you know, we've given kids, as I said, footballs and toothpaste and toothbrushes, and it's just unbelievable.
It's a true example of Jews being an Or LaGoyim, of being a light unto the nations, which is what we were put on earth to do. Besides for the very obvious legacy, incredible legacy, that your work leaves behind, what do you hope people will get from reading the book?
I'm hoping that people will learn tolerance for Jews that do not conform to the radical right wing that our religious world is going towards. If that's poor English, I know my English is not great. That's why David wrote the book. My previous book, The Traveling Rabbi, My African Tribe, was written by Suzanne Belling. I've been known for not breaking halakha ever. That's why I'm still accepted by the Beth Din of Johannesburg. I conform totally to their rules and regulations, but I'm totally tolerant to people that are married out of the faith. I'm totally tolerant to every single Jew who's treated equally. And that is what is so essential. If you explain to them why there is a difference, why they are in some places not accepted, etc. And in chapter 2, I think it is, there's an issue in one of the communities which is detailed very nicely and explained what the situation is. People can read about it. It's in the Western Cape. And they'll understand what the situation is. But every single Jew counts, and every single Jew matters, and whatever their level of observance or understanding. I had a case in Swakopmund, in my previous book, where there was a couple who for over 50 years were Jews for J, reborn Messianic Jews, if you want to call them that. And they fled Eastern Europe, never had a bar mitzvah. And at 83, I used to visit them regularly, and I said, doesn't matter, you're Jewish, I'm coming to visit you. He used to put on a yarmulke, his wife used to cut open an avo for me, and I used to have pravita and avo. They insisted I ate with them. And they were wished to be cremated, and for years and years I met with them. And one day he phoned me, he said, listen, I've managed to convince my wife that we're going to get buried. If you fly up tomorrow, you come with us to the cemetery, we'll choose two graves. And I flew up the next day, and we chose two graves, and they were both buried kahalacha. What they believed in, etc., but they changed their will to be cremated. And thank God we've had huge success, not 100%, to change many people's minds and decisions to be buried according to halacha and not cremated. And if that's anything, that's an achievement. So we do not negate people. And if they say, well, we want to be cremated, then walk away and say, well, you know, you're not part of us, you just choose the wrong way, and therefore goodbye. We don't do that. And your people will see at the back of the book, it says, every Jew deserves to feel part of the Jewish family, no matter where they live. That is why I travel, to remind them that they're never alone. And that's really what motivates me, that every single Jew, if it's for a piece of kichel and herring or a yahrzeit candle, or just they know, they tell me, you know what, don't ever bother me. We have many Jews that live in Mauritius, for example, that have moved there for tax reasons or whatever it is. And they say, you know what, don't bother me. But when I'm going to die, you're going to get a call to come and bury me. And that's fine. As long as they know, we're the Jewish connection for them.
This book leaves one with a profound appreciation for the power of showing up, for being present, even in places that others may have forgotten. The Traveling Rabbi Journeys Continued is a reminder that communities are not built on numbers, but by commitment, not only by institutions, but by people who care enough to show up. Rabbi Moshe Silberhaft and David Sachs, the Ahavat Yisrael, the love you both have for your fellow Jews, has been an inspiration for me and many others, and especially those of us, I think, who take it for granted that we have access to all things Jewish in a place like Johannesburg. Rabbi David, thank you for joining us on Bookmark.
Thank you.
The Traveling Rabbi Journeys Continued is launching in the coming weeks. Join the Johannesburg launch events on the 8th of July at the Chief Rabbi Cyril Harris Cultural Center with Rabbi Moshe and David Sachs in conversation, or on the 15th of July with Rabbi Moshe in conversation with Mandy Wiener at Exclusive Book Sandton. Please join one of those events or get your copy after the launch dates from Kollel, from Fresh Fellas, from Exclusive Books, Reader's Warehouse. Take a lot, the lot. It's a book you want to have on your bookshelf.
Turn the page. It's The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
To end off today's show on calling, on heritage, on preservation, I wanted to give you a taste of a book that celebrates heritage through the most universal language, and that is food. It's called Retro Karoo Food by Tony Jackman. And what he has done, in every part of every old Karoo house, there are memories of things that happened there. The front doors are portals to the mysteries that lie within, and the lives that have been lived there and the stories that have happened in their wide rooms with their wooden floors. Retro Karoo Food brings together 80 recipes from author, food writer, and playwright Tony Jackman's Karoo Kitchen, made with the love and spirit of the Karoo. Some are traditional, others adapted, and yet others his own invention. From skilpaikies, boengi sop and tomato bredie, to ginger chicken roasted in a poiki and parmesan gem squash. There's yapi sechinstelung, Karoo ice cream, and prickly pear syrup. Jackman also revisits cookery classics and tracks down the histories and variations of dishes like vata blommiki briri, which I've never actually tasted, and tipsy tart, which of course I have tasted on many occasions. There are no trends in this book, so there's no spheres and blobs and all the kind of passing fads that we're seeing in trendy cooking today. It's a throwback, a cookbook that distills genuine old South African recipes all in one place. So if you are South African at home or abroad, or a tourist wanting to get a taste of the local cuisine, or you want to just cook something delicious or nostalgic for midweek supper, braai, or a dinner party, this one is most definitely for you. I'll give you a taste, just some of what he writes, because his writing is so evocative. So besides for the recipes themselves, there's incredible photographs. And he says, as you page through this book, you'll see that the food has been photographed in my three favorite places in the Karoo: Die Tuishuise and Victoria Manor in Craddock's Market Street, Huntum Huis in Calvinia, and the period eccentricity that is the Lord Milner Hotel in Mikeysfontein. And that's on my bucket list. I certainly want to get there. These are spaces that represent the old times and the old ways, when life was kinder and people less demanding of life, and are the perfect settings for my kind of traditional South African food. So these photographs are just gorgeous, evocative. Although Tony Jackman is not a professional chef, he has been a food writer for many years. So what he has been able to do is share that enchantment that comes not just from the dishes, but from the experience of being in the Karoo. And I wanted to give you a sense of, he talks about a sense of nostalgia, and the images on this page is firstly of a beautiful dinner gong of old, and a beautiful old dining room in the Albert Dining Room in Victoria Manor. And he talks about being a little boy and going out for lunch in this very same hotel. In those old dining rooms, he remembers, there'd be a neatly typed menu, just one page at the center of the table, fastened by a wooden holder. You'd pass it around, or Mom and Dad would read what it said. Cream of celery soup, poached cob with parsley sauce. There'd be two choices of main course, roast beef and Yorkshire pudding with roast potatoes and vegetables, and then a supreme of chicken with new potatoes and peas. Dad would always choose the beef, Mom the chicken. You'd have to choose either Pears Belle Helene for dessert or vanilla ice cream. This was a neatly cut rectangle of firm textured ice cream on a side plate with a triangular wafer stuck into it. You didn't get to order Chico the Clown. Spur steak ranches hadn't been invented yet, and war survivors certainly weren't given to making food look cute to get their kids to eat. You'll ruddy eat or do without, as my Yorkshire father used to say. That gives you a feel. And I did actually look up the recipe for cream of celery soup, which I have never tasted, and I intend to make for Friday night. Let's see what it tastes like. Tony Jackman has been the food editor of the Daily Maverick for years, and writing its popular column, Thank God It's Food, TGI Food. So his writing is wonderful. It's evocative. It will transport you. And of course, the recipes are classic. There's very good reason why these are classic recipes that have endured. So this show was all about lives of purpose, people who have made calling and service their lives. We started the show in Mario Casar's Sicilian kitchen, but moved on to explore his passion and work in conserving our precious animals, birds, and habitat with his book, Tracks in the Dust. We tasted some nostalgic dishes in Retro Karoo Food by Tony Jackman, and we chatted to Rabbi Moshe Silberhaft and Rabbi David's and David Sachs on The Traveling Rabbi, Journeys Continued, a book about never leaving a Jew behind, and a book that is due to launch in a couple of weeks' time. Next week on Bookmark, we're diving into the books that keep us awake long past our bedtime, the nail biters, the page turners, the whodunits, the stories that begin with a mystery and end with us saying, ah, just one more chapter until suddenly it's 2 a.m. From twisty thrillers and psychological suspense to classic detective fiction and modern crime novels, we'll be exploring the books that keep us perched at the edge of our seat, second-guessing every character and racing to uncover the truth before the final page. If you love a good mystery, a shocking twist, espionage, spy stories, a story that refuses to let go, join me next week for a celebration of the art of suspense. We'll also be chatting to David McCloskey, author of The Persian and ex-CIA analyst. So join me next week on Friday the 10th of July as we sit you at the edge of your seat. Goodbye and happy reading.